Welcome, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, and this is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we're talking with the co-creator of Charlottesville, Our Streets, a new film about the tragic events that occurred here in Charlottesville on August 11th and 12th. Jackson Landers is here. He's a science writer who used to spend most of his time writing about things like coral reefs and harlequin frogs for Smithsonian Magazine, but at least since this summer. He has trained his pen on the alt-right riots, rallies, and hearings, and he's made this film, Charlottesville, Our Streets. It will be featured tomorrow at the Virginia Film Festival here in Charlottesville. We also get to speak with Barbara Brown Wilson. She is Assistant Professor of Urban Environmental Planning in the School of Architecture at the University of Virginia. Her research and teaching focus on the history, ethics, and practice of sustainable community design and development, and on the role of urban social movements in the built world. She's involved in a myriad of changemaker organizations focused on community design and youth leadership, and we'll talk with Barbara Brown Wilson about design as a tool for social equity. You can check out all our past shows on the station website, 947wpvc.org, chock full of all the amazing people that live here in Charlottesville that we've had the privilege to talk to. And now I must ask Nancy, are you there?
I have the privilege, yes, of talking to you. I am here, Ellen. I'm definitely here for show 31. You know, what's interesting about that is I believe it's 31 degrees out.
So I
think we're responsible now
nice
for how cold it is.
Yeah. So
we need to get to show 87 very quickly.
I know. No, okay. Oh, good point. I know it's a little colder out there. What kind of Celsius do you have?
What kind of
temp?
Excuse me?
What kind of temps do you have over there?
I think we've got the 31. I'm not lying about that. I'm pretty sure. Anyway, so speaking of things that are frozen blue, you had an amazing election, if I may.
Yes.
On Tuesday.
Yes, we had a blue tidal wave, and a lot of women took some power into the legislature here.
Elsewhere too. Yeah, I know. A lot of diversity. I love that word. Bringing it out, dusting it off after Tuesday is so nice.
And you know how to pronounce it. I'm grateful you know how to pronounce the word. So, Danica Rome, transgender woman, won a seat here by being a decent person and wanting to, you know, make some change with traffic of all things and other things.
Right.
She, don't you love how she defeated the guy who called himself the chief homophobe?
Yes, I love it. Yes, didn't he call himself the homophobe in chief or something to that effect?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
and she, you know, it was really moving. I heard her speak. Someone asked her, "What do you have to say to that guy, Bob Marshall?" And she said, "You know, now he's a constituent of mine, and I don't want to say anything disparaging about people." She was so sincere. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's so, again, refreshing to hear people just speak about other people like they're a lot, you know, with humanity versus what we're so used to, but
right.
Should not be used to, I realize, but what is everywhere else. I know you guys had, like, some, I wrote a few down, a lot of firsts. The first transgender, you had the first out lesbian delegate, you had the first Asian American woman, two Latina delegates.
Exactly.
It's just incredible,
yeah.
Obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say Dawn Adams became the first openly lesbian there. So, yeah, and Hoboken, New Jersey also got a Sikh mayor near you.
Yes.
Mayor who was facing a lot of racist attacks. Were you aware of all that being so close by?
Not until he won. No, I wasn't. I had not heard about all of it until then. No. It's such a weird, I know, all these, like, it's nice enough to know that people are rejecting what is in power, but these additional, like, layers to the stories, like, you know, Danica won because of parking or traffic. Or whatever, you know what I mean, to this guy, and then that guy Chris Hurst, also by you, who ran on, you know, reduced gun violence and won.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is hope, and, you know, the voting, I don't know, I think twice as many people came out for you know, against Trump than did for Trump.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I have it written down somewhere. Yeah.
I believe you. And also, what it's very much concerning to me, but you guys totally nailed it, is apparently you guys did paper ballots all the way down the line.
I think we did, yeah.
Yeah. Which I wish, you know, it just seems like the best obvious way to solve all the stuff we're not dealing with in Washington is just make it, they're going to hack, so just do paper ballots.
I know. It makes perfect sense. I think voting was up like 31% in Charlottesville here specifically, and 16% since the last governor's race in Virginia. So it makes a difference. All the talking we've been doing about voting, it really, really matters. It really, really matters.
Yes. So you can reverse some gerrymandering in Virginia and a couple other states maybe as well.
Yeah. Anyway. And again, women, you know, this whole, all the stuff that's coming out about women, let me just say, becoming unsilenced. Do you think this is, I know we're running a little short on time, but, do you think it's an unraveling, or do you think this is a good breaking open of what's happening here?
Well, I'll try and be short. I will say, I think, unfortunately, it's both. I think it's amazing, and I just skeptically or cynically wait for the backlash, I don't know what it looks like, but I don't want to go on because I'll push the show back too much.
Yeah, don't push it back. But I just wanted to say, again, just thanks to those women. Women run for office. Elizabeth Guzman, Hala Ayala, those Latina members you mentioned. And I wanted to say this, too.
Yeah.
Hold on.
No,
I'm doing something here.
Okay.
Can you hear that? Wonder Woman.
The dance party.
All right.
I'm putting on my gold armbands. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead. Please.
So Wonder Woman, that could be our next theme song. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Are you ready?
I think so.
Okay. Our first guest is a Wonder Woman. Her name is Barbara Brown Wilson. She is assistant professor of urban environmental planning in the School of Architecture at the University of Virginia. Her research and teaching focus on the history, ethics, and practice of sustainable community design and development, and on the role of urban social movements in the built world. We'll hear all about that. And we'll hear about how design can be a tool for social equity. Welcome, Barbara.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what do you mean by community-driven design? That sounds very abstract for someone who may not understand what that is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so the field of architecture has traditionally been one that was really driven by patrons, right? So, you know, rich people that sort of said, hey, this is how I want you to think about this question and how I want you to design for it. But design is trying to be really relevant to bigger social issues and break out of that patron model that's so, so limiting in terms of how you solve problems. And so there's a lot of words that have been used recently to think through what we, you know, how we might signal that in practice. And so public interest design was sort of one of the original terms meant to signify something like the public health spin off out of medicine that became its own field, but often that's not specific enough. So if you design a hospital, is it immediately public interest design just because it's in the public for the public? And so the field sort of moved to community engaged design as a language. And now, much more specifically, if the work that I'm interested in is when it's driven by communities that are traditionally underserved by design, what does that look like? How's it different?
How do you go about research like that, Barbara?
You talk to a lot of people. you have to figure out where, you know, communities are doing their own work really well. And, sadly, it doesn't happen all over the country, so it's easy enough to find. Then you go hang out with them for a while and ask them a ton of questions.
And is there, like, a different approach that you have for a vulnerable community versus other kinds?
Other kinds of research?
Yeah, no, the design that you do, is it different for a vulnerable community versus another problem in a different kind of community.
Yeah, I think so. That's what I've been really trying to figure out, is what is the difference. And it seems like the really successful ones, because sometimes, of course, people do say, nope, it's going to be exactly the same type of service. But the questions are much more complex, right? The if you're really going to be relevant to issues of social equity and systemic injustice, these things have been compounding themselves for centuries. And to try to say, you know, okay, well, we're going to solve this problem like we solve, you know, the design of a logo or a building is limiting, right? So in the end, there's lots of ways that you have to build trust. So the projects are long, they have compelling partnerships, because often you need to know not just about design, but about health and about how it feels to live in this place, and you know, art and expression and things that really come mostly from the neighbors themselves, but also from a lot of different perspectives. So yeah, the work looks really, really different. And often it's a lot more fun, because if everybody's going to spend their time on a Saturday, you know, with their kids and everyone else talking about design, it shouldn't have only a land use map driving the conversation. So often it's creative and it's a little bit more hopeful.
We're talking with Barbara Brown Wilson, Assistant Professor of Urban Environmental Planning. In a little bit, we're going to talk with Jackson Landers about his film, Charlottesville, Our Streets. This is 94.7 WPVC, and you're listening to Apropos of Something. Barbara, I wanted to ask you, could you take us through a project, maybe a favorite project, how it develops and what you do and what you've achieved?
Sure. Let's see. Since we're here in Charlottesville, I'll talk about a project that is ongoing, if that's cool. We're not done. I am lucky enough to be involved with Piedmont Housing Alliance on their redevelopment of Friendship Court. But I was brought in because they really wanted it to be driven by the residents that live at Friendship Court now. It's an 11-acre community. About 150 families live there. And it's extremely low income families. It's all Section 8 funded. And for obvious reasons, they care a whole lot about what happens to their community, but also don't have a lot of trust in the sort of powers that be, because we have a long history in Charlottesville and across the country in displacing poor people for, you know, for other people's interests. So what we've done there is acknowledge that we're going to have to build trust for years. It's going to be the slow food version of design. So it's going to take a while, but we have some time, and create leadership pathways and platforms. So there's a lot of young people that live at Friendship Court. And so we created a youth leadership and land use program where they got to learn for about a year. They were paid for their time, because if all of the middle-class white people are going to be paid for their time on a design project, then everybody else should too, right? Everybody's got knowledge they're committing. And it's an after-school program for a team of really exceptional leaders that live at Friendship Court. And so we've been talking about land use and some of the, you know, exciting stuff and some of the not exciting stuff, stormwater and representation, how you get your voice out there, all those things. They went to city council and held a mock meeting. You know, they've been all over town, but they now have such a voice that they've been asked to join the adult leadership platform. So I'll explain that quickly. The residents each got to vote on who they wanted to sort of represent a resident advisory board, which then really makes most of the decisions on how the project's going to move forward. And so I was excited when two of our young partners from the youth leadership program were asked to join the adult version. Both platforms kind of have this way that they're able to do a little bit of education, but a lot of just like, hey, what do you think? Let's talk this through until you're comfortable giving me your feedback in a real honest way.
Do you often, are you able bring in kids to get their involvement, to partner with youth-led initiatives like the one you just described?
Yeah, I think youth are some of the most wonderful partners in these projects, because they're not, you know, they're not completely confined by convention yet. So maybe they're willing to trust you. But even more important than that, they're willing to be super honest. People are very polite, no matter if they have a good relationship with you yet or not. And so youth are willing to tell you exactly what they think at all times. If you promise them that actually you'd really like to hear it, they will really, really tell you. So they're really helpful partners. They give you a lot of feedback on just what they see and then also what they dream of. And when they're a majority of your population, it's just a really important voice to take seriously.
And as far as like these community engaged projects you do, you've also, you've founded some organizations connected to community engagement. Which ones, you know, have had the most impact that you've started?
Yeah. That's a fun question. So one back in Austin, Texas, where I used to live, is a community design center. It's actually being run by a colleague of mine still today and doing great work, really trying to push the envelope on how we can think about, sustainable green design activities and really make them accessible and appropriate and relevant for lower income communities. So that one's, I'm proud of the work they're continuing to do, really connecting land use and health. The work I'm still deeply involved in at the national level is the Design Futures Student Leadership Platform that is really trying to create pathways to make these connections between social equity and design a lot more robust, and also have our young leaders in the field that might be underrepresented get the voice they need to change the field in real time.
So we're coming up on a hard break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Barbara Brown Wilson from the School of Architecture. In a little bit, we'll talk with Jackson Landers about his film Charlottesville, Our Streets. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. And in honor of the blue wave, to take us out to break, I'm going to play a little one of my favorite tunes. Welcome back to Apropos of Something, everyone. This is 94.7. We're very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Barbara Brown Wilson is here. She's Assistant Professor of Urban Environmental Planning at the School of Architecture. We're talking about design as a tool for social equity. Barbara, I know you have a book, Resilience for All. Is that what it's called?
That is. That's it.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So it's coming out actually in February. It's about four really exemplary cases of community-driven design. I find when I talk about this work, often people are like, yeah, but that's not a thing that can really happen. But it does happen all over the country and all over the world, although I stick with the country because one has to create a boundary so you're not talking about everything forever. So there's four cases that I go pretty deeply into. Often this work is sort of seen through pretty pictures and very rarely heard through the voices of the residents that helped drive them. So in this case, I'm looking at a project in East Biloxi where they did what they call the Bayou Bayou. A really cool community-driven bayou restoration project that resulted in some job training and some citizen science and 12 restored bayous. In New York City, a project that on the Lower East Side that really held space for a people's plan through kind of social practice, art, and tactical urbanism in a temporary park for a few years while they created permanent designs that really reflected the values of the people living in the Lower East Side today. A project in Denby, Detroit, which is one of the communities that is sort of at the residents describe it as forgotten in the post bankruptcy Detroit world. It's sort of northeastern Detroit near the 8 Mile, and it's a community that is really only marked by a set of schools. Public schools is their anchor institution. So really working with the students there to think through how they want to change their community in some pretty radical ways that that created not only safe routes to school pathways that in very real time, but also a very beautiful park designed and driven by the students themselves. A project and then the last of the four being in Portland, Oregon, in the Cully neighborhood, which they say is the most racially diverse neighborhood in Portland or in Oregon, which I don't think is incredibly hard to do, but it's a really diverse place, and they want to keep it that way. And it's at risk of gentrification pretty rapidly. So they've created a tool, a set of tools through a nonprofit that does, they say green infrastructure as an anti-gentrification strategy. So really keeping people in place while they improve the environment, so that you have the capacity to stay and enjoy what you helped build.
Do you ever have stories of people who have come up to you that have appreciated what you've done, or have had? Are there any moments like that?
Yeah, it's amazing how rare it seems to be that people are able to describe the ways in which design can be relevant to these big messy issues that we want to try to fix, and they like hearing stories about creativity and understanding that it can be thought of differently. I mean, we have a really sort of colonial perspective of design, and to think about how we could change that and how we could really remake the field so that it's still creative and it's still thoughtful and it's still really driven by brilliant inspiration, but really changing existing situations into preferred ones instead of perpetuating a certain type of aesthetic that doesn't resonate with all people.
Where did this interest in like community or public interest design come from?
For me?
For you. You know, what led you to this? The projects you work on are so varied and so interesting, and I was just wondering how did you wind up, with this focus?
Sure. I think I was really interested in why, if I, as a young person, I could sort of figure out that climate change was going to be a thing that, was real. It wasn't something that was easy to study in school unless you were just thinking about environmental sciences, which wasn't kind of where my heart was. And I wanted to understand the history of it and why it seemed to be only something that rich people got to do. And that pushed me further and further. So I've always been really interested in sort of affordable housing, because that was an early way that you could kind of, okay, lower people's energy bills, make it healthier for them. But they have affordable housing is a really fixed thing in so many ways, because the money is really complicated to keep it affordable for a long period of time. So the farther I got down the design road, and I really wanted to understand how people make change, how real residents make change in their communities. So design seems to be a really compelling vehicle for that, especially in the face of big issues like climate change that seem to be getting bigger all the time and hurting our most vulnerable populations harder than everybody else. It's important that we bring something hopeful and creative, but still also based in a sort of lens of equity and impacts and making sure that the change is beneficial to those who really need it.
So Nancy made me aware that you're the top 100 leaders in public interest design. You're recognized as one of. What would be something that your dream project?
What a great question. I feel like I get to do my dream. That's a really cheesy thing to say, but I partner in my most interesting projects. I'm really not incredibly creative myself with my hands. I'm make ugly things, but my partnerships, I work very closely with Gina Ripple, who's another faculty member in architecture at UVA, and we did a project in Gary, Indiana with the Astor Gates, which was amazing. We got to learn a lot from the local residents there and highlight their history of making and manufacturing, and that was super fun, and it resulted in something incredibly beautiful, because Gina's really talented, and the young people we worked with there were really talented, and it was a great project. But and we're doing that now here in Charlottesville, working with young people in public housing as well. We're just kicking off that project. So I think for me, the ones where I get to work with really talented, creative people, both with degrees like Gina, with licenses in the field, and then also with the people that are really coming with deep amounts of local knowledge, that's the sweet spot for me, because I'm just sort of the yenta. I'm bringing everybody together and making sure they all get to talk and that things end up good for the people that deserve the change. But when you can work with people that can also make things really beautiful and actually measure how the impacts have benefited people's lives. That's it. It's good stuff.
Those four projects that are in your book, are those also projects that you were involved with personally, or just were they chosen for the book?
Yeah, I intentionally wanted to do a third party review of these projects. We tell a lot of our own stories in this field. It's a scrappy little field, and there's not a lot of money to, you know, market yourselves beautifully, but we end up telling stories of all the good work we did. And it's very, very hard to talk critically about your own work, as well. Just, I think it's human nature, and also just, it's hard to see it. And so I chose four projects that I looked at really deeply that could stand up to a little bit of criticism because they were fantastic and tell their stories of how they worked really well, but also what failed, so we can learn from both. And then another four stories, mostly just to prove that actually this does really happen across the country, but that are done in lighter, you know, with a lighter touch, but that are also just really exemplary. So there's eight in there that you can get inspired by pretty easily, but also learn like, oh, that didn't work as well as they thought, but that's cool. We can figure it out.
So I hear that you use the word yenta. I'm going in a different direction here.
Yeah, go for it.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in, well, I moved around a lot. It was one of those families. I feel like my childhood was in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. I feel some obfuscation going on here.
Well, no, from 8 to 18. Well, when, you know, a lot of people, when you say, where did you grow up, they say where they were born. But I was born in Ames, Iowa, and was only there
really?
3 months. So, like, that doesn't really tell you anything about me.
Yeah, we have like 3 out of 4 Midwesterners here.
There you
at
go.
This table.
Yeah. See, now you define me as a Midwesterner. It's the only time I've ever lived in the Midwest.
Not defining you. Defining you.
Well, speaking of the Midwest, before you go, I was curious about that project you did in, I believe it was Gary, Indiana, mm-hmm. the art house, the social kitchen, because that seemed a little, in a way, a little different from things you've been describing this
mm-hmm.
morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so this was a project that was really run by the mayor of Gary, Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, who's an amazing woman, Gary native, and driven with the help of Theaster Gates, his artistic director, who, those of you who don't know him, he's got a TED Talk. He's an amazing guy, based in Chicago, artist in Chicago. And they won one of the very coveted Bloomberg Philanthropies sort of public art challenge grants. And the thought was that you would make public art that was, you know, really place-based, really beautiful, and really inspirational to communities that that wanted that type of change. And so I maybe never have contributed to a competition before, because I think being, you know, the people from away that come into a community is just doesn't feel right to me. That said, this was an international design competition that was meant to be community engaged and really community driven. And so working with Gina, whom, Gina Ripple, whom I believe in very much in her, you know, sort of ethical compass, and her talents, and trying to figure out, okay, well, how would you do this in a way that was really community engaged was a fun puzzle for me to try to figure out. We ended up working, with a set of foster youth through a group called Live Art Studios, and working really hard behind the scenes as we built the public art installation that that ended up being, you know, adorning the art house social kitchen. It's a long-term culinary incubator for small businesses that are coming up out of Gary, you know, Gary residents. And so we wanted to make sure that the future art was really done in a way that was kind of community-driven. And so we spent a lot of time thinking through with art house how all of the menu of options they could have when, you know, depending on who they wanted to engage and how in the future work.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Professor Barbara
Brown. For all your
Wilson.
Resilience. Thank
yes.
you.
Resilience, cool. Resilience really for all. Cool. Available in bookstores.
February.
In February. Everywhere?
Yeah. Yes. Thank
Great.
You.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Nancy.
Yes. Some news of note? Or do you have some
yeah.
sound effects? Do you have some
well,
sound effects
there'll be
of
some
note?
Sound effects. But I want you to go first.
I don't want to get in the way of that.
Okay. Are you ready? Well, mine have to do with my sound effects have to do with my news of notes, so you go for it first.
Okay. Well, okay. Mine is still ongoing, sadly. It's the constant mismanagement of the hurricane relief efforts. Since Hurricane Harvey hit, FEMA has given out $2.2 billion worth of contracts, and a lot of that has gone to companies with past violations for similar work or no record in disaster relief. I don't know if you've been or heard of the one. There's a place called GIBCO, which got a $74 million award to build mobile homes for Hurricane Harvey victims. All they had was a website on GoDaddy, which gave no phone number and it had an email address, but no information about who runs the company. And then, of course, the very well-covered one, which you've probably heard of, Whitefish Energy, that two-year-old company from Montana had just two full-time employees before Maria hit, and they landed a $300 million contract through LinkedIn, and from the connection being, you know, that's hard to deny, is that this is Interior Secretary Zinke's hometown. But after bumbling through this for a month, the governor finally terminated their contract. They, of course, got $8 million worth of work done, and that work apparently on Thursday failed again, or not failed again, but the little work they did has failed, and the power now in Puerto Rico, which was at a whopping 40% after 50 days, is now back down to 18%, thanks to Whitefish Energy. Anyway, it's
yeah,
still
that's
a big
story.
My point.
Right, let's
got?
Not forget Sorry. About that. No, totally. Well, you know, while all this stuff is going on, from sexual predation, guns, and then the normal distractions, I'm just happy for what I think is going on in the background. I'm going to take my time in saying the wood chipper of justice hopefully will be getting some justice done. So I wanted to say also, with all that distraction, what's worth noting is that there's a lot of bills being introduced into the House of Representatives that I think still needs our attention. I think people really still need to pay attention and call. Things like H.R. 861 to terminate the Environmental Protection Agency. There is a bill to terminate the Department of Education, to repeal the Affordable Care Act, of course, to defund Planned Parenthood. There's a National Right to Work bill, which of course is misnamed. It's really a right to fire people whenever people feel like it. There's bills against sanctuary cities and a bill to criminalize abortion. So, although we had a blue tidal wave, there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah.
Sorry, so depressing.
Is looking smaller.
Yeah,
okay, anyway.
And Larry Sabato, you know, our local, not hero, but our local celebrity here, had tweeted to his friends and pundits saying that, you know, demographics really didn't change here. This really is a repudiation of Trump. So I'm thankful for that.
I will take it every day. Yep.
Okay, so with no further ado, I wanted to introduce our next guest. Jackson Landers is the co-creator of Charlottesville, Our Streets, a new film about the tragic events that occurred here in Charlottesville on August 11th and 12th. Landers is a science writer who used to spend most of his time writing about actually fascinating nature stories like vampire bats and what they can teach us about friendship, ancient civilizations, exotic frogs for Smithsonian Magazine. But at least since this summer, he's trained his pen on the alt-right riots, rallies, and hearings, and he's made this film, Charlottesville, Our Streets. It will be featured tomorrow at the Virginia Film Festival, November 12th, 4:30 at the Paramount. So welcome, Jackson.
Thanks for having me.
So how did the switch of subjects occur from reporting on nature and frogs to this?
A little bit of it was gradual, and then a lot of it was sudden, I guess. You know, I got into journalism sort of accidentally. You know, I went straight from, you know, I had been writing books, and then I kind of went straight to writing for Slate and the Washington Post and doing these big science features. But, you know, I didn't go to J school, and I didn't have a normal route into journalism where, you know, you would go work for a small paper and be on a courthouse beat or something and kind of come up. And I guess it was like a year and a half ago, I realized that I needed remedial journalism. So while I'm writing all this stuff for, you know, I would do stuff for the New York Times or something every now and then, you know, while I'm doing this big level stuff, I went hat in hand to the Seville Weekly here and, you know, started pitching stories and doing just like local stuff. because I wanted to learn the kind of journalism that I had never done, the sort of street level stuff. I thought there's things I don't know that I don't know. And so in the course of doing this sort of, you know, local stuff, I started covering the stuff with the statue. And I think I remember the first time I saw Jason Kessler on the downtown mall gathering signatures, you know, for his petition to remove West Bellamy. And I thought, and I stopped and chatted with him for a few minutes. I thought, this is going somewhere. And I went in, I walked into Siva Weekly and told my news editor there. I said, I think we should write about this. She's like, I don't think this is going to get to anything. We'll keep an eye. I was like, no, I think this is going somewhere. And so from that point on, I was covering all of this stuff, even if I didn't have an assignment. And so it kind of snuck up on me. I thought this is going to be important. And I started being everywhere for all the statue stuff and the recall stuff that I possibly could. But then after the 12th, which I was covering for Rewire, and live streaming and all that, the next day I realized, you know, this is what I have to do. And I ended up taking a leave of absence from Smithsonian and doing all, just covering these stories. I mean, for a while it was 100 hours a week, and it's backed off of that. I'm getting some more sleep at least.
Wow.
But I realized that there's just so many stories spinning out from this, you know, whether it's the possible stand down order given to the police that day, you know, to, you know, all these trials like Chris Cantwell's, for example. There's just so much to cover. It just turned into a full-time job.
Yes, this is Jackson Landers. We're going to come right back. We have a hard break. We're talking about his film and his reporting. His film is Charlottesville, Our Streets. We'll be right back. This is Apropos of Something.
I think about 9:30, we started seeing people coming in tear gassed. They were being brought in, usually led by a friend. Their eyes were shut.
This is a clip from
the
movie.
In the midst of this, two guys in suits brought up a gentleman. Obviously, he couldn't see. We laid him down. He asked, "Where am I?" And the other nurse with me said, "Black Lives Matter tent." I felt him stiffen immediately. And then somebody said, "He's all right." I just said, "Sir, it's okay. I just think I'm Switzerland."
Clip from the movie, Charlottesville, Our Streets.
He's away from them.
Yes, they've been knocking.
At the same time, he's giving orders to his friends about calling this person or that person and etc. We treated him. I didn't put my thoughts or ideas or what I believe on him. And the same, he didn't do the same to me. I did ask him when he first came in, though, because I wanted to know who was actually starting to throw the tear gas. I said, "Okay, who did this?" As we're lying him down, he said, "I said, oh, well, that's what happens." I didn't know who he meant by that. He said, "Yes, I asked them not to bring that." I said, "Oops, okay." That told me his group must have gotten caught in some blowback or whatever. And he thanked me, shook my hand, and left. Later, I found out he was definitely one of the alt-right national leaders. I have to thank him, because it was difficult afterwards to realize I can walk my talk, that I really can treat people that believe so differently than I do.
Wow, that was a clip from Charlottesville, Our Streets, Jackson Landers' movie that's showing tomorrow at 4:30 here in Charlottesville. That was,
hey, Jess,
go ahead.
Sorry, Jackson, I was just, before you answer, like, the inevitable question about why you decided to make this film, because of that clip, I was just wondering, what was the process like of accumulating all of this footage, if I may?
Yeah, that's a good question. First off, I want to say it's not just my movie. Co-producer is Brian Weimer, who this would not have happened without him. And then Natalie Jacobson is an editor and friend who came in on this, and she was a big part of this. I guess there's two sides to it, really. So there's the street footage that goes into this, which was more or less crowdsourced. And so there were sort of two sides to this. There was, you know, getting these, you know, I think we had hundreds of hours of footage, it's safe to say, that people gave us. And so one side of it is taking all of this stuff that people are giving us and digesting it into something that we can use. And that's where Natalie Jacobson was really, really valuable. She's been a journalist and went to film school and so she can run a camera and edit. And unfortunately she was unemployed when I had the idea for this. It's like, come with me. We need you for this. And she took she was in charge of taking this incoming footage and figuring out what the timestamps were. And people would have the dates and times wrong on their cameras. So we would have these sort of beat points like, okay, we know the gunshot was at this time, or we know that this announcement on the bullhorn was at whatever time, and you could use those cues to kind of figure out, okay, this is what time a clip begins and ends. And we built a library where visually it was like a chart of like little lines, you know, and the line is showing how long the clip is, and so we could go into this big chart and see, oh, okay, what was happening at 8:52 a.m.? Well, here's 15 different things that cover that time, and here are all these different views. And so we built this library. And then it was a process of condensing it down in terms of what we were going to use. So, okay, well, whatever we want for 8:52 a.m. Well, this footage is too grainy and this is pixelated. And well, maybe this is, this other shot is a little bit shaky, but it shows some action that nothing else shows. Like, oh, this is where somebody raises a cattle prod or something like that. And so there was a process of taking that library and condensing it down until we actually at one point had that Natalie made a very watchable, like 3-hour film that was just street footage for 3 hours. Now we had to be 90 minutes for the film festival, so that's one process. And I should mention, we never had we didn't have an outline. We didn't have, you know, a script starting off with this, because the process of making the film, I mean, it's a piece of journalism. The film is a piece of journalism. It's like a long form magazine or newspaper article, you know, visually. And so the process of making it was an investigation. We didn't have a particular axe to grind or direction that we were going. And so that's how we do it on one side. And then of course the interviews have to match up with it, and we were able to make these two sides of it. The interviews match up with the footage really easily, because right away we decided we're going to stick with a strict timeline. Everything is in consecutive order of, you know, we're not doing anything cute jumping around in the timeline for the most part. Where, you know, it starts, you know, on with a torchlight rally and goes through the day, you know minute by minute, hour by hour. And so these things just kind of matched up. We did on camera I think 30 some interviews, and there are a lot more people I talk to not on camera. And so that process, you know, doing the interviews, I was very accustomed to doing interviews. I think I approached it with a pretty good sensitivity. I conducted most of the interviews. Brian Weimer did a few without me, but it was mostly me doing them with Brian or someone else running a camera. And, you know, before I was a journalist, I was the subject of news a lot for just the classes I was teaching, the books I was writing, the things I was doing. So I've been on the other side of hundreds of interviews on radio, on TV, and for print. And I know what it's like to be that person on the other side.
So you've been reporting, you went to Tennessee, you reported on the rally that was supposed to happen there in Murfreesboro and Shelbyville.
Yeah.
You reported on the Cantwell hearing just the other day.
Yep.
What is it that what have you learned?
Here's a big thing. Actually, the first person to like express it in these terms is actually Brian Weimer, my partner on the film. But the one thing we've learned from all of this is that everyone involved in this stuff, whether it's, you know, alt-right people, you know, neo-Nazis and KKK people and Confederate and just flag supporters who aren't necessarily Confederate flag supporters who don't think of themselves as racist, and the medics and Antifa and Black Lives Matter and the cops, everyone thinks they're saving the world. Everyone involved in this, like everyone who was out there on the 12th, everyone who comes into the courtroom for Cantwell's hearings, including, you know, Chris Cantwell himself, everyone thinks they're saving the world and that they have to be there.
Wow.
So before, like I said, I do want to hear this answer. What drove you to make this film?
Well, I guess I think it was like the Monday or Tuesday after the 12th, I think, and a friend, Salah Baloch, wanted to interview me on camera and just have me tell him the story of what happened to me on the 12th. And he didn't have a plan for it. He was just like, well, I just think this stuff might be important someday. And so, you know, I went over and he filmed that. And afterwards, I was like, you know, wait a minute. Like, so right now, this is a moment when you can get good interviews with people. The longer you wait after an event like this, after any event, when people start telling you their stories, after a while, it's just the way that human memory works. You're getting the memory of the memory. You know, when somebody's told a story enough times, they kind of set into a pattern and memories change. And the sooner you get this stuff, the better it is. And I realized that so many people were out there with cameras that, you know, there was probably, I realized there was probably a complete documentary film hiding in people's, you know, SD cards and hard drives. And what if you could you get all these pieces and put it together? And so just had the idea. I was like, and I said it right away. It's like, oh, we have to make this film. And Slaw was like, it's like, yeah. And actually he did some cinematography for some of the, or videography for some of the interviews. And so I went back in the downtown mall. I was meeting a friend for a drink, and I was telling him about this. And right away he said, "Well, I can help you find the money." You know, 20 minutes later, I had tens of thousands of dollars pledged. I mean, and then people are suggesting like, "Oh, you should work with this guy Brian Weimer. He'd be a good director to work with." And I ran into John Kelly, who does PR for the film festival, after I had a beer with these other friends, and I just said, "Hey, look, I want to make this film. I think we can pull it together. Would you make room for us at the festival in November?" Which is insane because it's just a few months away at that point. And I just outlined the idea for it. And, John said, "Well, okay, let me talk to the programming director. This is a maybe. This sounds like a great idea." I said, "We already have this racial justice kind of theme to things that would fit in." And so literally within the space of an hour, I had the idea. I'd found, potential collaborators. I lined up the money and had, my fingers crossed on a birth at the film festival, and we just like ran. It was just like 100 miles an hour. Just like, we just have to do it. So that's where it came from. And as far as motive, it was also, it's really frustrating for a lot of people here seeing. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong. I've been the media guy coming into another town and telling a story there. I was just in Tennessee a few weeks ago covering some of that stuff for the Daily Beast. But I think a lot of people here have been frustrated by global media descending on Charlottesville to tell our story for us. People who don't know Mudhouse from Miller's, trying to interpret this and say, "Oh, what does this mean for Charlottesville?" People who don't know anything about Charlottesville that are saying, "Well, this is what this means about race and whatever and social justice in Charlottesville." And, I felt like it's time for us to tell our own story. Everyone who worked on this project, including, Lauren Hoffman, who did a song over the closing credits, the people who gave us the money for it, everyone involved is from Charlottesville. And so it's us telling our own story and taking back our own narrative. And those are all the things that went into coming up with this film. And I also thought just like we needed something that was an objective telling of it, like a durable document that someone could watch in a classroom 50 years from now that would tell you what happened. And there's no speculation in this. We don't editorialize. People aren't allowed to say things that nothing makes it into the film if somebody said something that they don't know to be true. So we'll allow somebody to say how they felt about something, but when they try to say this is what someone else felt, this is why someone else did something, we don't let that in. We don't allow any kind of anything we couldn't prove, anything stated as a fact that couldn't be proved. We left it out. So we wanted an objective telling. But anyway, so those are, this is a long-winded answer to your question, but those are the motives for why and how we made the film.
Are you at all? Let me not lead you in. Sorry. So what are you feeling about showing it at the Paramount tomorrow?
It's a weird spot to be in, to have something so terrible that I've been buried in for months. I mean, every day, all I do is deal with this stuff. So I hope it doesn't sound perverse when I say I'm just delighted with the film, and I think people are really going to like it, and I'm really looking forward to sharing it with them. I mean, that said, it's like, I don't know. I guess I know how Steven Spielberg felt when he made Schindler's List. Like, to try to make something you're so pleased with and you want to show to the world, but it's about something really terrible. So I have, mixed emotions. One thing I'm thinking is I really hope that, people who were there on 4th Street during the crash, there are a lot of people who are walking around with serious PTSD and trauma where they shouldn't watch this movie. There are people who I've told, don't go. Maybe in a year, maybe 2 years from now, we are going to. I hope there was talk of the festival having maybe some counselors available in case somebody's people are having difficulty and need to step out. So there are a lot of people I'm really looking forward to showing this to. There are some people who I think just they're just not going to be ready. It's going to be too painful to watch. But I feel the film is ready. I'm so proud of it. I'm so proud of the work that everybody, working on this did, from the wonderful editors to what Brian did to, all these very brave people, these 30 odd people who did interviews. you know, they're taking a risk. Like, you put your name and face on camera for something like this, you're risking doxing and reprisals and threats. You know, I had somebody cut my brake lines while I was working on this. Somebody literally tried to kill me. I don't know that it was about the movie. It may have had something to do with all the reporting that I was doing. But, you know, you're taking a risk, and these people are very brave. And so I'm just so proud of all these people. And the film's ready, and I'm very excited.
Wow. So that's tomorrow. I don't know. Are there tickets left?
No. This sold out very quickly. That said, there will be standby tickets. So 10 minutes before showtime, if your butt is not in your seat and you have a ticket, you know, your seat will be, you know, made available to someone else. So people who stand around on standby, there is a possibility to get tickets. And also, if you look at the Facebook page for the film Charlottesville, Our Streets, we've got a little discussion thread we put on there so that people who have tickets and can't go or have an extra ticket can, you know, connect that with somebody who wants one.
And if you can't get in, is there a way to see this after? What are your plans?
I have no idea. we've been so focused on just getting the film done for the festival. We haven't been talking to distributors or anything. The film is getting so much attention. There's a story in the Washington Post today about it. It's the most complimentary article I've ever read about any documentary film, actually.
Congratulations on that. That's
thank you. So I think there are going to be opportunities. Just a few days ago, at the opening gala for the film festival, a journalism professor from Germany said, you know what, we've got three different universities in and around Berlin that I can get your film and you booked at, and you as a speaker, and two places in Austria. So, like, there's already a European tour coming together for it. I would like to barnstorm with this and take it to colleges, you know, all over. I'd been thinking all over the country, but apparently they're talking about this film in Germany. Like, before this woman had come, she said, her daughter said, oh, you're going to Virginia, you have to see this, you know, August 12th movie. So I want to take the film just, you know, right away. Like, you know, the week after the festival, I'm ready to go with this thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll fly in anywhere to show it. If we get, you know, distribution, if we get, you know, some kind of deal with whether it's Hulu or whatever, that's cool, but I'm not waiting for it.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it has a life of its own.
Yeah.
We only have a few minutes left, but if you could just briefly, my last question would be, what is your hope for that life of its own that it would do for people?
That's a really good question. I want people that watch the film to look at people as people. I mean, instead of caricatures, because it's so easy to say, well, Antifa, they're just a bunch of people who are just like breaking things and they're horrible people. No, that's a human being, and they're there for a particular set of reasons, and there's a reason they're doing this that makes them feel good about themselves. And or the militia people that were there, you know, they're doing a weird thing that I wouldn't do. I don't agree with their political beliefs, but, you know, what they're doing comes from, it's a very human place. They have a sense of responsibility, and they're doing what they're doing. And the same thing with the street medics and the Black Lives Matter people. I don't want any of the people who are come to these things to be looked at as, you know, caricatures or kind of put in a box. You know, they're all human beings that are there, again, because they're trying to save the world.
Well, thank you so much, Jackson Landers, a co-creator of Charlottesville, Our Streets.
Thank you for making that film, documentary.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I hope you'll come back.
Sure. It's a little early in the morning for me on a Saturday,
not
usually.
Really. But, I don't believe it. This breakneck speed is evident in everything you say. I don't believe you.
Yeah, I think it's because you were up all night covering, you know, hearings and things like that. Thank you.
All right, so I have a five-second palate cleanser, if I may. May I?
Yeah, but before that. Palate cleanser music. What do you think?
I like it,
okay.
Actually. It's,
okay,
it's very, it's very cleansing. In lieu of Jackson's documentary, last week the human rights movement Black Lives Matter was awarded this year's Sydney, as in Australia, Sydney Peace Prize for its highlighting of America's race issues.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And mine is that Nutella changed its recipe.
Ah, no.
Nutella is now lighter in color. It has less fat, more sugar, and less chocolate. I think we need to have a rally about that.
Is this like a new Coke thing, or did they do good?
No, yeah. I don't know. I think people are complaining. People are outraged.
Of course. Nutella. People are complaining. I can't believe it.
So next week on our show, we have Melvin Loeffler, expert on history of U.S. foreign relations. He writes about the Cold War, political economy, and national security. And Cyril Kunakovich. He's a historian of modern Europe, and one of his courses is titled Life in Dictatorship, Surviving Authoritarianism in the 20th Century Europe, and I hope we never need to study his class.
Oh,
so,
my goodness,
once
Ellen.
Again, thank you so much, Nancy, all our guests, Jackson Landers, Barbara Brown Wilson.
Yes.
Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Thanks, Nancy.
Got it. Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.